I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And thanks to all who participated and organized in the beautiful 34th annual Wisconsin Dr. Martin Luther King celebration. We are going to talk about politics for the remainder of this hour, and Dr. Martin Luther King will figure into some of our discussions. All things political with David Zwerdlich. He's associate editor of The Root. On Friday of this week, President Obama addressed concerns about NSA surveillance. David writes that his speech isn't going to be cheered by the civil libertarians, and it shouldn't be, but it would probably be endorsed by any of his predecessors and probably his successor. As you will remember, Dr. Martin Luther King was heavily surveyed by the FBI. We'll talk a bit about that. And does that figure in at all to present-day concerns about surveillance? On the celebration of what would have been Dr. Martin Luther King's 85th birthday, income and wealth gaps between blacks and whites continues to grow. Unemployment among African-American men is very high. The gap in standardized test scores is large. Why, we will ask. State investigators sent 20 subpoenas to Chris Christie's inner circle. We're now beyond the George Washington Bridge scandal. Was 2013 President Obama's worst year, and concerns grow over safety at the Winter Olympics in Sochi? We'll be welcoming phone calls for David, and here's how you can reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. David, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Hi, David. You know, when I think about how old Dr. Martin Luther King would have been, 85, Nelson Mandela lived to be in his 90s, and I keep thinking, what a loss, how wonderful it would have been to have him talk about the many issues that we're going to talk about today.
No, absolutely. And I think, one thing we talked about on The Root this past week was this idea of people looking back and trying to sort of imagine or speculate from a variety of different lenses about what Dr. King would think about our politics today, what he would think about a variety of issues that are, you know, the kind of things in the news today. And I think on some of those things, we have a fairly good idea. On others, you really don't know. And you're right, it would be quite valuable to have an elder statesman, 85-year-old Dr. King, to weigh in on some of these things.
Let's start with the NSA and do it thinking about the life of Dr. King. As people remember, after he delivered his I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington, the government, really, and particularly the FBI, wanted to bring him down. An FBI memo referring to King as the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in the country. Do we think about how surveillance has been used to try and bring down Dr. Martin Luther King, of all people, when we're looking at the NSA surveillance now? Is there any connection?
Well, there is a connection, and President Obama did draw that connection in his speech on Friday, as your listeners know. The president really gave this exhaustive explanation of his view. People can agree or disagree with it, but I do think it's fair to say it was very exhaustive. And to your point, Kathleen, the president invoked everyone from Paul Revere all the way up through Dr. King, and he talked about the fact that it is rather breathtaking that Dr. King was seen by the security establishment as this ultimate threat, and now he has one of four who have a national holiday in his honor. It's quite a remarkable change in a half century. And President Obama also talked about the fact that while he now, as president, oversees the national security state and the National Security Agency, he acknowledged that people like Dr. King made it possible for him to be the first African-American president. So, again, people can take different sides on this, but clearly ironies abound when you're talking about King and where we've come.
Yeah, they sure do. And you write, and this must be what's behind it. I don't want to be too simplistic about this, but you write, any American president, past, present, or future, would rather deal with complaints that they're too aggressive on national security rather than too weak, particularly after 9/11, which, what do you say, changed everything, changed how we view this kind of surveillance, and certainly changed how the presidents will deal with this?
Well, Kathleen, a couple things. First of all, I think that since last summer, the debate has gotten a little more a little healthier and a little bit more specific. Right back in June and July of last year, when Edward Snowden was reported to have revealed all these things about the NSA, it was this whole discussion of, is Snowden a traitor? Is Snowden a hero?
Right.
Is he a leaker? Is he a whistleblower? And I think that has kind of calmed down, thankfully, and now we're in this discussion, okay, of what is the proper role of the national security apparatus and the president in it, and what do we as citizens accept? What I was writing about over the weekend is this idea that, you know, from my perspective, again, people have tended to see President Obama, because of his personal profile, as someone who might be a little bit less inclined to have a robust or aggressive national security state. But the reality is that once someone, regardless of where they come from on the spectrum, once someone emerges as the President of the United States and as the chief executive, those concerns frequently outweigh ideology. And President Obama, being a constitutional lawyer, being someone who at least started out on the left, even though I would say he moved quite a ways to the center, you might think he'd be inclined to roll back the security state. But once you become the commander-in-chief, your concern is, hey, I am ultimately responsible for protecting the United States and the people of the United States against threats, real or perceived. And he's going to kind of go about it from that perspective from here on in. And I don't think people should be surprised by that, because it's the nature of the job.
So who's going to be in charge of all of this metadata? You say that Obama would rather let Congress deal with it, and they probably won't, which means what? Nobody will do anything?
Well, I guess the debate right now is this issue, in terms of the mechanics of it, right, this issue of right now, the NSA, as I understand it, is actually gathering metadata that's first gathered by internet and wireless service providers, and then warehousing it themselves. And some people who would like to roll back some of the NSA's power in this regard are saying, at a bare minimum, they'd like to go further, but at a bare minimum, right, let's leave that metadata, all of our digital communications, with the communications companies until and unless the NSA actually needs to retrieve something specific with a warrant or a ruling in order to follow up on a terrorist threat. And I guess the debate is whether that's, you know, again, it's this balance between privacy and security. Will they be able to get a warrant and get court approval fast enough in the case of, let's say, a national security emergency to retrieve something that they don't already have warehoused at the NSA versus, you know, all of our personal communications being held onto by the government? And it's very tricky. I think reasonable minds can differ on this, Kathleen. But ultimately, again, as a political writer, I'm looking at it through the lens of the president's eyes, and I'm thinking that the president would rather have as much control over this information as possible, even if it's skirting right up against the edge of constitutional protections, because he's thinking about those threats,
right?
And that is the nature of that job as president, as opposed to, say, a civil liberties attorney or an average citizen.
And then you look at what's going on in Russia, and there is a great deal of concern about how safe the Olympics are going to be. The State Department here has issued a warning of people going to the Olympics, and so you're thinking, well, I sure hope they know what's going on there, the Russian authorities.
Yeah, no, that's right, Kathleen, and good grief. I mean, I was seeing a story earlier today. I am not really covering a lot of what's going on in the Olympics, but I did see a story earlier today talking about how there's been some challenges between cooperation between Russia's security apparatus and ours and some other Western countries in terms of how they're going to work together to, you know, monitor security or terror threats and to protect athletes and people visiting for the games. And I think that's an ongoing story. I confess I haven't looked into it, but one thing I do think is that it's not funny, but at this stage of the game, with all of the digital communications and with all of the potential threats out there, it's almost like what country would even want to have the Olympics anymore? It's sad to say, but I mean, it's just a huge headache. I mean, if there's one episode in Sochi, not only will it be a tragedy for anybody who's hurt, but it will be a blow to Russia's credibility. And I think, you know, Brazil in 2014, they're going to have the back-to-back, the World Cup and the Summer Olympics. These are real challenges for even big countries.
Yeah. David Zwerdlich is our guest, and we're going to move on to Chris Christie and other issues. But I am interested. David, in his recent column, talked about the fact that 68% of Americans say the NSA intrudes on their privacy, but only 2% say that how the president has dealt with all of this is one of the president's major failures. Is this issue of concern to you? I just wonder, do people, or is it a whole different world, as we've talked about, since 9/11, and any president would do the same thing? Here's our phone number for you to join All Things Political, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Let's move to Chris Christie for a moment. It's suddenly gone beyond a bridge scandal. He's facing a ton of subpoenas. It's looking a little nerve-wracking for him, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it is. And you know, in these kind of situations, I do like to take the approach of it is a he said, she said, or a he said, or what have you in
right.
this case. And I'm prepared at this point, as a writer, to say, okay, you can take Governor Christie at his word, at least to this point, if he says that he did not order this bridge closure, or if he says he did not do a pay-to-play in Newark, as is being reported now. But at a minimum, though, even if you believe him in that regard, and perhaps more evidence will come out that will call that into question, at a minimum, though, it makes him look like his administration is, tries to push people around, that he doesn't have full control over his staff, and that at a minimum he has some very vindictive people working very high up in his administration, and it doesn't reflect well on him. It also, at a bare minimum on the pure raw politics, Kathleen, took away from what was supposed to be a very positive inauguration from him for last
yes.
week. He was supposed to be emerging as one of the Republican frontrunners for president, and now it's more like, how does he just stay, keep his head above water, let alone try and run for president?
Well, what's your sense of how Republican leaders are responding to him? I read that Lindsey Graham is saying, we really don't want you to come campaign for me because nobody will want to talk about me. They'll want to talk about you. We hear that other people are coming to his defense. Do you have a sense of how much support he's getting from Republican leadership, David?
Well, here's what I see as Christie's problem now. And again, this is irrespective of whether it turns out that he's guilty of anything inappropriate or untoward or illegal even. And that is this. He was seen generally as being not as conservative as some of the other potential 2016 Republican presidential contenders, Senator Ted Cruz, Senator Rand Paul. Christie was sort of the mainstream center-right guy that was going to be more electable in a general election. And he was, I think, Kathleen, that, the way he was going to approach that 2016 presidential campaign was to say, look, I'm more mainstream, but I've still got this kind of tough guy, Jersey guy, every guy attitude. Now that the Jersey guy attitude is no longer as much of an asset for him, I'm not sure what he's going to do when he's in this Republican primary against people who have more staunch conservative credentials. He's got time to work it out, but I think it's a much bigger challenge. I would also argue that your governor in Wisconsin, Scott Walker, is probably the biggest beneficiary of these recent developments. All of a sudden, he emerges as the sort of, I'm not as far right as Ted Cruz, but I'm not as far left as some other people guy. He's not going to talk about it yet, but I would argue that he and maybe Jeb Bush are the biggest beneficiaries of all this.
And yet Governor Walker has said that he gave his support to Chris Christie. What does that mean?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, here's the thing, right? If you're one of Governor Walker's advisors, you've got to be telling him, look, one, we are the beneficiaries of Christie's fall from grace if it turns out that Walker runs for president. But then number two, you tell him, don't say anything nasty about the guy because, it's one of those things. If someone who's a potential rival is, sort of stumbling, you don't say anything. You just get out of the way and let him stumble,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that's where the Walker people probably would be. And that's not a knock on Walker, that any politician would take that approach.
Mm-hmm. And who would be Hillary Clinton's rival, David?
Well, former Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer is emerging as this guy who wants to run to her left in the primaries. I'm a little skeptical of this as a potential candidacy other than as sort of a protest candidacy, but he has emerged, and I think his idea is that he wants to be one of these, you know, Buddy Romer, you know, Ron Paul-type protest candidates, and that's fine. I'm not sure, though, that someone has emerged to Hillary Clinton's left who would present a serious, serious challenge to her. I don't think he's that guy.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, if Hillary Clinton does not run, Kathleen, then I think you're looking at an interesting cast of characters like Vice President Biden, potentially New York Governor Cuomo, like Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. And I think these are all pragmatic politicians who want to be ready, but also who realize that if Clinton is in the race, they will have a very hard time, mm-hmm. you know, challenging her.
And what do you make of some people saying that the Democratic Party, and the president for that matter, are starting to become a little more progressive? The president is supposed to be highlighting income inequality, increase in the minimum wage at his State of the Union address. There is conversation that Elizabeth Warren has been moving the party and those kinds of issues front and center. Is the Democratic Party becoming more left, more progressive, or not?
Well, I think some leaders are emerging, like Senator Warren, who are progressives, and I think that's a good, robust debate to have within the Democratic Party. Just going backwards for a second, and this ties into what we were talking about with Dr. King a minute ago, I've said this on your show before. I don't see Obama as a progressive. I think Obama is as middle of the road, down the middle, centrist as they come. And I think he has governed that way. Obviously, not everyone agrees with that. But that again goes along, Kathleen, with the idea of when you're president, when you go from being a state legislator to being a U.S. senator to being president, you know, you're representing a broader cross-section of America, and as a result, your politics go down that center lane a little bit more. And I think that's where Obama is. I think that's where Clinton is. Some of these folks, like Senator Elizabeth Warren, I think they really are becoming champions for these progressive causes. And I think the best way they might be able to champion some of those causes will be to solidify their positions of power in the Senate. For instance, if Elizabeth Warren on the left, or say, just as a counterpoint, Rand Paul on the right, wound up being president, they might have to moderate some of their stauncher positions on any given issue. Versus if Elizabeth Warren solidifies herself in the Senate with a series of 2, 3, 4 terms, she has the potential to be sort of a flag bearer for progressive causes in the way that, say, Senator Kennedy was, or other past really, really powerful U.S. senators. And a lot of that comes with sort of not always being perpetually seen as a presidential contender and just solidifying the voice and the power base that you have within Congress.
David Zwerdlich is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day. We welcome your phone calls, and here is how you can reach us. A lot of things that we've already talked about, where the how Republican leadership is responding to Chris Christie. We've talked about NSA surveillance, remembering the history of surveillance of Dr. Martin Luther King, which was not a pretty story. We are talking about possible terrorist threats at the Olympics. We're talking about front runners, who is the rival for Hillary Clinton, who might be a rival for Chris Christie. And, those are just a few of the things we're talking about. Given that today is what it is, I think that we'll look at inequality, too, as we move along in our discussion. But feel free to join us. Our lines are open, and you can call at 800-486-8655, email at talk@wpr.org, or you can always send a message on Facebook, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Oh, and we're also on Twitter. That's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Zwerdlich is with us for All Things Political, Associate Editor for TheRoot.com. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Ann in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, I thought that Scott Walker might be the beneficiary of Chris Christie's whatever he's done, mistakes, missteps. But do you think that the fact that Walker is undergoing his second John Doe investigation, that he turned down Medicare money for Wisconsin, that he has gotten millions and millions of dollars from out-of-state billionaires, that his, you know, his exterior doesn't match his actions at all, that he doesn't have a college degree, would any of these factors make any difference to the country when people are voting, do you think?
Well, yeah, no, Kathleen, let me jump in there.
Sure.
No, let me be clear. No, Anne, I think that's a great question, and I would say, first of all, I'm not predicting a President Scott Walker in January of 2017. I think we're a long ways away from that. I'm simply saying that in the Republican primary during 2016, I think if Christie is diminished, the two people that I see as benefiting the most from that, if they run, would be Governor Scott Walker, who, of course, is your governor in Wisconsin, and also former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who I think with a strong Christie and a Walker would have a hard time wedging himself in there. But if Christie is diminished, I think that leaves a lot of room for Walker and Bush. In terms of Scott Walker, to answer your question, Anne, once you get to a general election as opposed to a primary, I think the fact that he has been an active opponent of Obamacare, the fact of what went down in, was it 2010 or 2011 when you guys had all of the standoff in Madison over public sector unions, that sort of thing is not going to play as well in a general election. But it will play well for him in a Republican primary, and so the question is, and Scott Walker, even though, you know, for people, because you're in Wisconsin, you know, people in Wisconsin see him every day. When people don't see someone every day, he's able to make a sort of a newer impression on people as opposed to people within his own state who are already very familiar with him.
Thanks, Ann, for the call. An email from a listener who wonders why Ted Cruz continues to be mentioned as a candidate. Wasn't he born in Canada and can't run? I remember that he's okay on that front, but I can't remember why, David.
Yeah, and, you know, the funny thing about the Ted Cruz, if we must use the term birther issue, is that it's actually not the same issue that came out with President Obama, even though there was no legitimacy to the issue with regard to President Obama. President Obama always claimed to have been born in the United States in Hawaii and was born in the United States in Hawaii and had a birth certificate from Hawaii. In the case of Cruz, right, he, you know, there's no question that he was born in Canada. And the question is that because one of his parents was a United States citizen at the time, his father was originally from Cuba, is he a U.S. citizen by birth? And I think judicially most people lean toward yes, because his mother was a U.S. citizen. But there's a tiny sliver of room for disagreement in there, but I don't think the impediment to Ted Cruz is really going to be where he was born. I think that, again, he will fare well in a Republican primary because he is a hero to a lot of people on the far right of the political spectrum. I'm not totally convinced that he will play well to a general election audience if he somehow gets the nomination.
Martha in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a question for your guest, and before I ask the question, I want to agree with your guest as far as President Obama, you know, being a centrist, and I'll be honest with you, I'm really disappointed with him as our president. I mean, he's done a lot of good things, but I guess I looked at him as being kind of more progressive and towards the left, and that's, and I'm a little disappointed that, you know, he's more centrist, but I agree with the whole governing thing, you know, lots of different ideals, so I get that. But my question is in regards to the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And in our household, we are, you know, union members, and I'm an educator. My husband worked in a factory all of his life. And so we're Democrats. And I don't know if you would call us strong Democrats right now, but we talk about this at home. What is your guest's opinion and viewpoint in regards to the Democratic Party and the Republican Party? And, you know, where does he see the line being drawn between these two parties and what they stand for? Because I just see the Democrats being a bunch of wimps. I'll be honest with you. I love Elizabeth Warren, and I'm so glad she's in there. But I just feel like the Democratic Party, they're so far removed from people like myself and my husband, and they just don't get the daily struggles. And I just feel like they continue to forget about the people that vote them in there.
David.
Yeah, no, I think Martha actually laid that out really nicely in terms of how people are questioning and looking at our overall national politics right now. I will say that her view is shared by a lot of people, I think. When you look at a place like Wisconsin, right, you have some well-known conservatives like Paul Ryan, like Governor Walker, but Wisconsin also has a very strong progressive, very strong Democratic tradition to go along with some of these other trends in the state. That's not the case in a lot of these staunchly red states, right? I am a North Carolinian. In North Carolina, yes, there are Democrats. Yes, President Obama won this state in 2008, barely. But going from here southward, it is a very, very conservative part of the country. And so in order for Democrats to compete nationally, they do have to take that into consideration. And going back to what we were talking about with President Obama, the broader your reach is, when you go from being a state legislator in Chicago to being U.S. Senator from Illinois to being president, you do sort of expand your policy outlook because you're representing that many more people. I think Martha hit the nail on the head when she said there are a lot of people who call themselves either Democrats or liberals or progressives who do have some disappointment in the president. And we as a country over the last 5 years have had to sort of adjust focus. Kathleen, we've talked about this before, where you have a guy who was really billed as a change agent. Part of it was his own image making for himself in his 2008 campaign, a young guy from a multicultural, multi-faith household, interesting backstory.
Very
grew up
interesting.
In Honolulu, you know, Honolulu prep school, all of the above, had such, you know, inspired a lot of people. And it turned out, though, when you sort of drilled down into a lot of his policy positions, he has actually done a lot of the things, to many people's chagrin, that he said he was going to do. You know, he said all the way back in 08 he was going to stay in Afghanistan. He probably didn't flesh out his positions on the financial sector as much, but his last meaningful vote as a U.S. senator was a yes vote for the TARP bailout. And these are some of the things that we as a society have had to sort of adjust our focus to in terms of the two political parties. And I think this is why Martha's question is so key. It's that, you know, what is conservative one day and liberal another day depends on the times and the person, right? I have said to many people, partly in jest, but also just to get at this exact issue, if you look at someone like President Obama, is there anything that President Obama has done that wouldn't have been done by, say, a moderate Republican like President Ford or President Eisenhower or President Teddy Roosevelt? I'd say unlikely. I'd say, you know, Obama and these guys, whether they're Republican or Democrat, are in line on the sort of a middle of the road, not too progressive, certainly not too conservative agenda. And I think that is actually what you get from most presidents. There's the occasional, you know, Calvin Coolidge, who was very much a small government libertarian. There's the occasional, I'm trying to think of someone who was, in his own way, President Carter was progressive, although he also had strong support from evangelical Christians, but he was very much a dove on issues of war and peace. But outside of these exceptions, I think certainly in the 20th century, When the type of people that we as Americans elect president tend to be people who fall in between the 40-yard lines.
Yeah, you'd have to go back to FDR, I would think, to look at a truly progressive administration. You think?
Yeah, I would agree with that, Kathleen. Right. I mean, and part of it again was the times, and part of it is Kathleen. I'm so glad you brought up FDR. I don't know why my mind went to Jimmy Carter immediately, but here's the thing too. Some of it is that Nixon goes to China thing, right? Because FDR was someone from sort of an aristocratic class, had been a governor, was seen as a someone who had no personal stake in the plight of the common man, he was able to do a lot for the common man. On the other hand, you have someone like President Obama, who comes from this multicultural, multi-faith background. He is a person of color. Sometimes it is a little easier for him to be aggressive with his drone policy or sending SEAL teams over into Pakistan because they're playing against type. And that, we don't want to think of it that way, but I do think some of that does factor in.
Yeah. Thanks, Martha, very much for your call. Because we're remembering Dr. Martin Luther King, I want to talk about violence for a moment. The theme of this year's celebration is nonviolence. I'm remembering the year that he was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was subsequently assassinated. And here we are now in an age where we've got these school shootings that it just is driving me to despair about what's going on in this country. I remember
it's awful.
It is horrible, and it's sort of there were only two people who were injured or died, and so it doesn't even become a huge story anymore. There were calls in Chicago today for a no-shots-fired day. I don't know how that's been playing out, ringing church bells in favor of nonviolence. King's daughter, Bernice, saying that America has an enormous appetite for violence. Oh, how I wish Dr. King could talk about violence today and how we should respond, what the moral response is to all of this. But I must ask, David, why politically is it so hard to do something about this and that we're just putting up with seeing these reports of kids bringing guns to school when they're 11 years old and 12? What the heck's going on?
Yeah, this is one that I wish I had just a clear answer for you on that, and I am as appalled as you. You're right. Nowadays, it seems like there's a school shooting every week or every other week, and unless it's a mass shooting and unless it's something like Sandy Hook where there are these small, just innocent children, it doesn't even make news for more than a day, and it's really, really a sad commentary, as you said, on our society. I also think you're right, Kathleen, that we are lacking that, we're lacking that figure like an 85-year-old Dr. King, what he would be today,
right,
who had that moral authority to sort of grab the country and the Congress by the lapels and say, we've got to do something. In terms of why it's difficult to get gun control legislation at the national level, it really does, I think, my answer isn't any better than anybody else's. It comes down to the power of the NRA lobby versus the power of the gun control lobby, and I think that this is one of those few remaining social issues, this is how I look at it, where the conservative point of view is still dominating. In other words, when you look at something like marijuana legalization, certainly something like gay marriage, I think maybe abortion is a stalemate, but on a lot of these issues, the conservative point of view is not winning the argument. On gun control, the conservative point of view, for better or worse, is still winning the argument.
David Zwerdlich, our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. We're welcoming your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. On Twitter, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Saul in Stevens Point next. Hi, Saul.
Yeah, hi. During the government shutdown, I noticed that the Koch brothers disassociated themselves from that action, which was a Tea Party action. I'm wondering if this is the beginning of the defunding of the Tea Party, which at one time the Republicans thought they could control, but it was pretty clear that they did not. And that was confirmed, I think, by the brashness of Boehner, who is not known for his brave stance against the Tea Party, when he just basically told them to clam up and pass the budget bill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, and I think the point about the Tea Party is interesting. They are at an inflection point right now. The Tea Party writ large, is at an inflection point now because I think there's some strength for the Tea Party for the further right congressional candidates around the country coming up in this 2014 election. Much beyond that, though, it's a real question mark because in 2016, demographics are not going to favor a far-right candidate, and President Obama will not really be the issue anymore. He has been a lightning rod and a sort of a negative inspiration, if you will, for the Tea Party movement. But with President Obama out of the picture, it's not clear to me what the animating force is going to be in the Tea Party. You could say that, or maybe they would say that it would be deficit reduction or, you know, returning power to the states. But their legislative agenda that they've pursued since 2010 doesn't particularly bear that out. So I think it's a real question. In terms of the Koch brothers, I think they're just savvy businessmen, and they like to back winners, right? So once the government shutdown turned out to be sort of a loser, I think it was just made sense for them to try and put a little distance themselves between their funding and their agenda and what was going on Capitol Hill, which was a mess for Republicans.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sol. Kathy Wapaka, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of obvious, but it does need to be pointed out that the NRA has a lot more funds to work with than the gun control movement. And this is true of any big issue in politics. The money talks, and politicians know this. They need that money. And unfortunately, that is the way the game, I hate to call it a game, is played, because too many of people's lives depend on this game, and they depend so much on funding. And if they tick off big supporters, they can count on losing their money.
David?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, and I hope I didn't suggest a moment ago that when I was saying that the gun control movement was losing the argument, that I thought they were losing it purely intellectually. Part of winning the argument is having that fundraising. That's your caller is dead on, Kathleen. The NRA and other pro-gun lobbying groups have done a better job of fundraising. They are flush with money from individuals, from people who are gun owners, and also from gun manufacturers. And they have shifted to the right over time as well. I think, enough of your listeners probably can remember when the NRA wasn't against, say, background checks. But because of the way our politics have shifted overall, it has become this sort of zero-sum game where the NRA and other groups that have common cause with them have opposed even incremental gun reform. And it's been difficult for advocates of gun control to get a lot of traction in that when they are at a money disadvantage. And again, I do think some of it is this broader cultural argument that we're having, whereas some issues like gay marriage, conservatives know they've lost the argument. They haven't given up yet, but they know they've lost. And on the same time, on something like gun control, the advocates of gun ownership are still sort of holding the dominant position in that discussion. Back to the thing about Obama being a centrist and what Obama's agenda was starting out 5 years ago, it strikes me that Obama really did not want to get into this issue as a main agenda item in his presidency. Once the Sandy Hook massacre occurred, he had to step in. But really, he did not jump into this debate until a year ago at the end of his first term.
Yeah.
Before that, it was a back burner issue for them.
But when he did so quite movingly.
Oh, I think he did, and even though we talked earlier, Kathleen, about how progressives have been disappointed with the president on a variety of fronts, it's not clear to me that progressives should be disappointed in him over the past year on gun control. In last year's State of the Union, he devoted a lot of time to trying to get background check legislation passed. People, your listeners who watched last year's State of the Union, remember him with the refrain over and over, they deserve a vote. He brought up Hadia Pendleton, the young teenage girl from Chicago who had been killed just before
yes.
the State of the Union.
Yes.
Michelle Obama went to that funeral. He did a full court press for that. That one, you can blame a lot of things on Obama. I think this is one that really falls at the feet of Congress, though.
So how is he going to deal with the issues on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day? We need to address inequality in this country. And these very dismal statistics that Black Americans are much more likely than their white counterparts to struggle economically. The Black jobless rate is twice that of the white jobless rate, and it has done nothing but widen over the past couple decades. How will the president, and should the president, and how can anybody address all of that?
Yeah, this is somewhere where I think the more accurate criticism falls on President Obama and his administration. Even though the overall unemployment rate has ticked down a little in the last couple of years, even though the black unemployment rate has ticked down from 14%, 13% to now it's in the sort of mid-12%, we know that a lot of that is because of people just dropping out of the labor force altogether. And we know that even if it's going downward, something like a 12 or 12.5% unemployment rate for African Americans is really scandalous. And when you narrow your net and cast it just for African American males under a certain age, boy, that cohort, that statistical cohort, you're talking about a 35, 40, 45% unemployment rate. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it really, really is scandalous. The president has gotten a lot of criticism both from the left and the right for that, and they've really struggled. I think economically, people who have fared better under President Obama are people with 401ks, which is a lot of us, right? The stock market is if it stays on track, it's going to triple within his time. It went from the mid-sixes to the mid-16,000s, in the last 5 years. So if you have a 401k, this administration has done well for you. He has kept the tax issue as not a stalemate in Congress. They've reached some agreements on taxes, for better or worse. And overall, the economic picture in terms of GDP growth, Kathleen, has improved from when Obama took office, and we were at negative GDP growth coming out of the last quarter of Bush's presidency, first quarter of Obama's. GDP growth is slow, but it's a steady upward trajectory. But when you talk about people who are black, Latino, younger, not college educated, the employment situation is, as you said, it's dismal, and that is an area where the Obama administration is either has not emphasized properly, or they are out of ideas, or they're that is where they I think the criticism is rightly placed.
Do you expect some new ideas at the State of the Union on this?
Well, I think it's the stuff that we've been hearing about for the past few weeks, right? Democrats, including the president, have seized on what they think is a political winner in the push to increase the national minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Republicans have some economic arguments against that, saying that it will discourage hiring by small businesses. It's not clear to me that there's an economic consensus that Republicans are right about that. At least politically, I think this is potentially a winner for the president and for Democrats in the 2014 midterms. But that's an increase in the minimum wage for people who already have a job, right? Regardless of the minimum wage, if you don't have a job at all, then your wage is zero. I think the other thing that is a political winner for the president, Kathleen, but we'll see how it plays out, is this fight over extending unemployment benefits.
Right.
Some people criticize.
We have about 5 seconds.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. Well, it's fine. Look, no, I enjoyed it.
I did too, David.
Happy to come on anytime. Thanks,
Thank you,
Kathleen.
David. Thanks so much. David Zwerdlich, Associate Editor for The Root. com. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Tomorrow we'll look at that horrible West Virginia chemical spill tomorrow during our 1 o'clock hour. Thanks for listening.